Hello, I'm Kelly Burley for The Voices of Oklahoma. Frosty Troy's life revolves around the words he writes and speaks, whether it's on Oklahoma's public radio, in the Oklahoma Observer newspaper, or on the national lecture circuit. Frosty Troy maintains a hectic schedule to bring listeners and readers his take on what's happening in the Sooner State and the U.S. And regardless of whether you agree or disagree with Frosty's views, one thing's for sure, he's never at a loss for words. Today, however, Frosty takes a break from his role as commentator to share his life as an Oklahoman. Forrest Frosty Joseph Troy was born June 13, 1933, in McAllister, the sixth of 11 children born to Ruth and Leo Troy. His father owned a dry cleaning business in town, and Frosty's uncle worked at the state penitentiary.
We used to dwell in love's own palace, a palace of dreams come true.
He would talk about all the violence at the prison. And of course, I'm a little kid, you know. I'm just absolutely wide-eyed. This is unreal. But if it hadn't been for that prison, which was the local big industry, the joke was at statehood, we had a choice between the college that went to Wilburton or the prison. But very few people went to college in those days, but an awful lot of people went to prison. And so it was quite an industry there. My wife-to-be, Helen, didn't know it at the time, but some years later, her dad, they'd lost their farm out at Crawford. He went to work for the reformatory, and then he moved to McAllister for a pay raise. And of course, see, I wouldn't have had Helen if it wasn't for that prison. Mm-hmm. So, but it was the big industry there, and we kids, we used to sit around out at night when there was going to be an electrocution. They used old Sparky then, the electric chair, and we would sit out there, and we would swear that we could see the lights dim when they threw the switch. Of course, it wasn't true, but all the stories you hear. And then the hitchhikers, boy, every time you'd see a hitchhiker, boy, you know that's probably a killer. You kind of grew up in a prison culture. I went to school with some of the guards' kids and some of the officials' kids out there, and you sort of get used to it. One of the first things you find out is Uncle Buell said, you don't have to worry about it because the first thing they want is out of McAllister. They're not going to hang around. Now, if you leave your keys in your pickup, they're going to steal it. But, you know, they're going to light a shuck. They're not going to hang around McAllister. It was a fun little town to grow up in. We had a nice swimming pool and a lot of athletics, as you can imagine. And it was a very warm, caring little town. I remember one night we were going home from a Harvest Festival downtown on Halloween, mm-hmm. and we passed Parkview Grocery and Market, me and one of my little brothers. And they had the canned goods stacked up against the window, and we wanted to shake the window and make the canned goods fall. Instead, we broke the window. Well, guess what? There was a lady sitting on the porch over there. She recognized the Troy boys. She called the police. By the time we got home, which was about 4 or 5 blocks away, Chief Roy Anders was already there waiting on us. It scared the fire out of us. Dad said, "Won't you take him to jail? Put him in jail." but they didn't. But in a small community, people keep an eye on each other. And that, you know, it does take a village. And that was really wonderful.
As the Troy boys grew older, they worked at their father's dry cleaners. But Frosty had to earn his spending money another way.
All of my brothers worked there, but I was little. Dad thought I was going to get hurt. A lot of machinery. Those extractors are dangerous stuff. So I started carrying a paper route, Route 15A, and I carried it. And then I worked Saturday mornings at Gabe Guerra's Grocery and Market, and I stocked the shelves. And then Saturday afternoon, I went to the Star Drug, and I worked for them, and I cleaned all the gum out from under the counters, and I restocked and cleaned up all the trash and took it out to the bins in the back. And I did that for $1.25. That's what I got. And I was usually there three and a half hours. But, hey, it was a lot of money. And my paper route was just wonderful because I met all of these great people. And then I found out that people would even deadbeat a little kid. I'd have people leave without paying for their – it's 18 cents a week. Jeez. And they would deadbeat me. And then you learn a lot of other things, too, on a paper route. I recommend every boy in America have a paper route. Now they're all gone. You know, they're all by adults now, except in the small towns. But I was collecting one Saturday morning and down below Fifth Street Hill in McAllister. And I rang the doorbell, and this woman came to the door, stark raving naked. It scared me to death. Well, I stopped. I got on my swim, my bike, and I pumped all the way home.
Frosty attended Catholic schools in McAllister, and it was there that he says he knew he would one day become a journalist.
I had a nun. Her name was Sister Mary Andrew, and she taught English, and she had a master's degree, I think, from the City College of New York, if I'm not somewhere up there in New York. and a very brilliant woman and a tough teacher. Well, one day I'm walking down the hall at St. John's, and she says, "Frosty Troy." Well, you know, when you're in a Catholic school, you know, when they say your name, you're either in trouble or you're going to run an errand. And I said, "Yes, sister." And said, "Frosty, I saw your poem in the school paper. That was really good. Have you ever thought about being a writer?" Well, my Lord, she went right on by, just a comment. Honest, teachers don't know how they touch lives. Wow.
Do you remember the poem?
No, no. Somebody's got a copy of it. Someone sent me a copy of that paper once.
It is better to have loved you, dear and lost.
The St. John's Siren, May 25th, 1947, my first byline. Junior high reports interesting activities. Now that tells you a lot, doesn't it? And your byline in those days always went at the bottom. Sincerely, your junior high reporter, Frosty. A friend of mine in Tulsa had saved these old sirens, and first time she saw my name, that's when she. And I'll tell you how small our school was. I made first base. And I couldn't even throw straight. Could never hit a ball. But we were at a little bitty school. But I'm really proud of that.
Shine, little globe, glimmer, glimmer, shine. On this edition of The Voices of Oklahoma, we continue our conversation with Oklahoma Observer editor Frosty Troy. Today, Frosty recalls hearing the news of the Korean War. It was 1950, and Frosty was spending the summer in Dallas with his brother Pat when he made what he considered an easy decision.
I hitchhiked home to join the Army because I couldn't believe that the communists had invaded the country. You got to know the Troys. Now, we're more patriotic than anybody else. I mean, you know the Irish. Oh, good Lord. So, myself and my brother Johnny joined. My brother Kevin joined. I joined. My brother Bernard tried to join, but he had an eye injury, and he tried to fake the eye chart over at Camp Chaffee, and he couldn't even see out of his left eye. It was so bad. He later got that fixed, by the way. But so three of us wound up in Korea in the winter of 1950, and my brother Kevin was killed on Heartbreak Ridge. I brought his body home. My brother Johnny, he stayed in. He was in the engineers. He's one of the sapper teams that blew the Han River Bridge when the Chinese crossed the Yalu. By the way, my brother Kevin got the Silver Star, which is, I guess, on the Army, about the second highest, right under the Congressional Medal of Honor. Quite a guy. He was 22, by the way, when he was killed. So I came home, and then I wanted to go to OU. But in the meantime, it was between breaks, so I went up to the local newspaper. I'd sent columns home constantly. I didn't even know it. I was already famous when I got back to McAllister, because every time there was a little downtime in Korea, I'd write a little column home about whatever I saw and whatever I was doing. And they were publishing them, and they were putting them on the editor had a page one left-hand column, the full column, and that's where my columns were appearing. So when I got home, I was already something of a celebrity because I was writing about all the kids that I knew. I'd run into the kids from McAllister in the 45th and so on. And so I went to work for the newspaper there until I could start OU.
Frosty would attend OU on the GI Bill, but the classroom would only serve to frustrate a budding journalist.
I went in one day to see Dr. Fayette Copeland, the dean, and I said, "Hey, I'm really unhappy." And he said, "Why don't you go to work?" He said, "That's what you want to do, don't you? You want to be a writer, don't you? You want to report." And I said, "You bet. I loved it down at the News Capital." He said, "Well, you won't have any trouble finding a job because you can handle words pretty well in the journalism department." My little semi-fame had spread. So I got a job, believe it or not, at the Muskogee Phoenix. And I started as a police reporter, and inside of months, I was sports editor.
Wow.
I mean, from police reporter to sports editor. And the Muskogee Roughers at that time had four starters at OU, including the Burris brothers. Woo! That was tall cotton. I was going up on Monday for Bud Wilkinson's, he had that Monday press conference for the media. Oh, boy, you talk about it. I was suddenly in tall cotton. But it was such a rotten newspaper. It was so corrupt, the Muskogee Phoenix in those days.
Frosty quit the Phoenix following a request from the paper's managing editor.
He sent me over to the police department one night. He said, "Hey, kid, go to the chief's office. It's just across the alley from the paper and pick up. There's a package over there for me." And I came back carrying a peck sack full of whiskey bottles. And I put them down on his desk, and I said, "What is this?" And he said, "Oh, my wife, she's having a party at the country club. She's a big golfer, by the way. She's a pro. In fact, it was a woman on the pro circuit for a while. And said, she's having a big party. And, you know, they just pour this out anyhow. This is, you know, they confiscate it. Oklahoma was dry then. I set that stuff down and resigned on the spot.
Really?
Yeah, no job in sight. I had to borrow $200 from my mother-in-law, McAllister, while I was waiting to make my next connection.
It takes some guts.
Oh, no, it takes some stupidity. I've told many a journalism class since then, look, give yourself a go-to-hell fund. Every month, put away a little aside. Just, I don't care how much, but enough where if they tell you that you got to do something bad or something wrong, you can tell them to go to hell, but you can still survive and get to the next job.
After the Phoenix, Frosty got a job with the Lawton Constitution, but quit that job after the publisher refused to print Frosty's two-part story on slot machines, saying the story would be bad for the community's image. Frosty went on to work for a Lawton radio station before beginning a lengthy career with the Tulsa Tribune. That story, plus the beginnings of The Observer, next time on The Voices of Oklahoma. I'm Kelly Burling.
Turn the key on. You are equipped with taillight neon. You got a cute vest pocket master, which you can make both slow and faster. I don't know who you took the shine to, or who you're out to make a sign to. I got a gal that I love so. Glow, little glow and glow.
We continue our visit with veteran Oklahoma journalist and commentator Frosty Troy. Today, Frosty remembers his days with the Tulsa Tribune.
But it's still a Friday.
I went to work for them, I think, in either 54 or 55, and what a news. I had died and gone to heaven. I worked for them 14 years. I was never told how to write a story. I never had a story slanted. I never had a story killed. I was a City Hall reporter. Jenkin Lloyd-Jones was the owner and publisher, and he used to tell the newsroom, we'd have these meetings where they'd stop the phone calls, Margaret, the receptionist, hey, you just do the news. We'll take care of the opinions. And, man, he meant it. Boy, every now and then you'd kind of slip something in a story that was sort of your opinion, and whoa. Well, Harmon Phillips, who was the managing editor, and he sat out in the newsroom. He didn't have a private office. Can you imagine? That's why it was a great newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so I was City Hall reporter, and, you know, I was considered the little kiss butt. The guys would be taken off to shoot pool after deadline, and the guys would be going around to, you know, just to mess around, and I wouldn't go. I was mowing, working. And, hell, I was tearing up page one. I had more page one stories than the other reporter on the, well, Frosty, kiss up, you know. But they had suddenly made me assistant city editor, youngest one they'd ever had, and I'm still just a kid. And then before you know it, they had an opening at the state capitol. Boy, before you know it, I was the youngest bureau chief ever at the state capitol that anybody knew of. And boy, the state government was just my meat and potatoes. I knew I had died and gone to heaven. Jeez, that was more fun. Howard Edmondson was governor. He was a reformer. The Democrat old guards from eastern Oklahoma ran the legislature and hated him and tried to kill all of his bills, and yet he had the public with him, and he was passing things like central purchasing, the merit system, legalized liquor. I mean, I could go down the list. He's still the greatest governor this state's ever produced if you're looking for production, for actual accomplishments. And I just loved it. And then before you know it, they asked me if I wanted to go to Washington. So I went to Washington, and boy, that was great fun. Jack Kennedy was president. I'd go down to the old State Department auditorium to his press conferences, and God, I got to cover stuff, and I'd see all these senators that I'd seen on television and so on. And boy, you know, it was great. Barry Goldwater, I covered his hearings on Indian Affairs. Wow, it was wonderful. And then they had an opening for associate editor, which is the number two man on the paper, and they asked me if I'd come home, and I said, I don't want to. And Jenkin Lloyd-Jones, the publisher, said, look, we've been really good to you. The family really likes you, and we think you owe it to us. We want you to have this position. Well, what are you going to say? Yeah. He'd flown all the way to Washington, you know. And that conversation took place at National Airport. And so I came back, and that was a mistake. I was never meant for a desk. Mm-hmm. I was never meant for an administrative position. I'm too hyper. I had a nun, second-grade nun, Sister Mildred, who used to tie my ankle to my desk. I mean, it wasn't maliciously. She used a scarf, but I couldn't stay at my desk. I'm all over the room. Yeah, hey, how you doing? Yeah, fine. Let me look at that. And I'm still that way. I'm still 55 miles an hour. Pat McGuire was the water commissioner at City Hall in Tulsa, and he nicknamed me, and everybody in that building called me the Roadrunner. And a lot of them, when they would pass me in the hall over there, would go, beep, 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 beep. That was how you said hello to Frosty, because I was always on the move.
Frosty gave up his desk job for a second stint with the Trib State Capitol Bureau. But by then, Jenk Jones's son had taken over the paper, and the two disagreed over Frosty's coverage of then-Governor Dewey Bartlett. Frosty eventually left the paper for good after receiving an offer that was simply too good to pass up.
Father Johnny Joyce was editor of the Catholic Diocesan newspaper, and I had been sending him stuff for years. If there was anything on marriage or divorce or any social issue, Jack Bickham, a journalism professor at OU, was editing it for him. And Doyle May, who was assistant sports editor to the Oklahoma Journal, was actually doing the paste up and some of the writing. And then I was contributing the stuff from the state capitol. And it was a labor of love. Every now and then he'd send me $20 or something, big deal. He met me at the capitol one morning and said, hey, want a newspaper? And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, we're going out of business. And I said, what? Man, that is a slick little news. What are you talking about? He said, oh, you didn't know the little council met at St. Gregory's and they withdrew the subsidy because we opposed the war in Vietnam. And I said, well, man, I don't know. I'd have to talk to Helen. How much you want for it? And he said, $1. Really? That's what I paid for. And I said, well, can I use the office for a while till I find a place? Sure. What about the equipment? He says, that doesn't work half the time, but you can try it. So I moved down to 606 Southwest 3rd in Oklahoma City, quit the Tribune, resigned by teletype, which somebody got a hold of at KRMG. I wasn't doing commentaries then. And the DJs read my resignation letter on and off all day long. It was funny, you know. I don't want to spend my life kissing Dewey Bartlett or anybody else's butt. I'm a reporter, you know, and without fear or favor. So Helen, she said, fine. I would have never done that without her permission, and because it's a partnership. So she started publishing the paper in a bedroom in our home because she wasn't about to leave the kids. And I was working two part-time jobs. And boy, it was a real struggle. Wow, was it a struggle. But man, it paid off. Not in fabulous circulation and not in fabulous money, but that little journal has really made a difference in Oklahoma. And for a lot of people, it's the only second opinion they get or read.
At first, Frosty sold advertising to keep the Observer afloat, but then decided to rely on subscriptions to ensure that he would uphold the same standards that he admired so much in his early bosses at the Trib.
They set such an example for me at the Trib. Jenk did, and Harmon Phillips. I'll tell you how much so. I have two children. One of them's named Philip. He's named after Harmon Phillips, the managing editor. And I've told him the story about Phil and what a great editor he was. And I said, you shouldn't name people accidentally. They ought to have somebody to look up to. There ought to be some reason, family or history or, in the case of professionalism.
Today we conclude our series with veteran Oklahoma journalist and commentator Frosty Troy. Today, Frosty discusses the influence his parents, Doc and Ruth, had on his work ethic.
Dad died at 74, worked himself to death, really. Mother's 92. She still dances two nights a week at the Senior Citizens Center. She's a hoot. Her mind is as clear as a bell. But Dad was up at 4 every morning because he had to fire that boiler. He had to have that steam line ready when people got there. They didn't close the cleaners till 6. Then he had to count the money, put the money in the safe and all that, and get home. And, boy, I've seen him sit at the head of the table so tired he could barely. And it was hot. You didn't have central air conditioning in those days. And during the summer, see, he had to let those people off at 2 in the afternoon because otherwise they'd faint. They were literally grown men. Pressers would just go down.
So how did Forrest Joseph Troy get his name, and how did he come to be known as Frosty?
I asked my mother, this is a true story, I was about 10, and I said, Mother, why'd you name me Forrest? Nobody else is named Forrest. And she said, oh, honey, I named you after my high school sweetheart. And I said, no kidding, Dad's name's Leo. And she kind of chuckled, and she said, oh, honey, you were number 6. By then, there was no jealousy. And I remember that story just as plain as day. And she had a little high school sweetheart, you know, named Forrest. And
how'd you get the Frosty?
Her dad, my grandfather, Hopkins, he did that. He nicknamed me Frosty.
Boy,
no, as a child, as an infant. Practically from the time, mother said, practically from the time I was crawling, it was Frosty. And I don't know why, and I still don't know why. And I've met 3 other Frosties now who were named Forrest.
Really?
Yeah, you tell me how you get from But how do you get from Jack to John and John to Jack? I mean, some of these nicknames are just wild.
Frosty Troy edits the Oklahoma Observer from a small office north of the state capitol. One of the centerpieces of the office, a giant refrigerator covered from front to back with political bumper stickers.
This is my second refrigerator. Unfortunately, the motor burned out off the first, and this is a golden oldie. And every time I get a bumper sticker, and I don't care if it's Republican or Democrat or whatever it is, I put it on it. And, you know, sometimes you have to double up, but some of them are really great. Boot Newt, you know, he's gone. Say No to Hate. Oklahoma's Future Goes to School Today. Flush Rush, that's my favorite. Rush Limbaugh, you know, his ambition is to die in his own arms. Clinton Gore, 96. I've got a David Boren here, Glenn Johnson. Great, you know, just, it's fun. Well, the back office is absolutely full of plaques. Listen, if you can't get a speaker any other way, give him a plaque. The average journalist will drive halfway across America for a plaque.
Boy, isn't that the truth.
And he'll pay his own gas. But there's just something about wanting a pat on the head. But the wall here you see are some of the more the awards. There's the full page Time magazine did on me called The Sooner Scourge. And a friend of mine, I didn't do that. She was in our bridge club, and a friend of Helen's. And they decoupaged that and brought it to me. The fountain pen you see up there, taped by it, David Hall passed the first significant tax increase for public education in the history of Oklahoma. And I had been writing on education and writing and how great the needs were. And imagine my surprise. We were in the blue room the day he was signing the bill. And when he signed it, he leaned over and handed me the pen. Wow. I mean, that just knocked me down. All the awards are wonderful, but one of the ones that I love the most was I got the National Friend of Education from the NEA and 8,000 delegates in Philadelphia. And Helen was with me. And I wasn't supposed to speak. I was just supposed to get it. And I got up and I started thanking them. And people started yelling, speech, speech. So I spoke, but not long, for about 10 minutes. And then they kept saying, speech, speech. More. And the guy behind me, the president, wanted to stay on schedule. And he's pulling the back of my pants. If I counted right, last year I did 129 speeches in 26 states. And looks like this will be a bigger year. 2000 will be a bigger year. In fact, as I just got back from Michigan, where I did 6 speeches in 4 days. Just got back from Nashville, and I get to run all over the country. People don't realize what a big, beautiful, wonderful country this is.
Frosty Troy maintains a hectic schedule, and while his opinions will continue to be a unique part of Oklahoma's political and social landscape, Frosty is eyeing the day when he can enjoy the fruits of his labor.
So it's been a great run, and Helen and I are about to finish our run. We know that, and nobody wants the paper. The people we want to have the paper. I want to do like Father did to me, bless his heart, Father Jack Joyce, rather. I would love for somebody to walk in and pick it up for a dollar. I would love that if they would just keep doing what we're doing. And just giving people a second opinion. See, we don't pretend to be anything we're not at the Observer. This idea of changing people's minds, come on. If you can change your mind that easily, you're weak-kneed. If you make people think, real journalism, real opinions, and that's what we are, a journal of commentary, makes people think.
Shine, little global. On this edition of The Voices of Oklahoma, we continue our conversation with Oklahoma Observer editor Frosty Troy. Today, Frosty recalls hearing the news of the Korean War. It was 1950, and Frosty was spending the summer in Dallas with his brother Pat when he made what he considered an easy decision.
I hitchhiked home to join the Army. Because I couldn't believe that the communists had invaded a country. You got to know the Troys. Now, we're more patriotic than anybody else. I mean, you know the Irish. Oh, good Lord. This is the truth. I went to Korea weighing 115 pounds, came back weighing 117 pounds, telling people the Army made a man out of me. Jeez. In basic training, the guys had to help me up with the pack. You know, 10 minutes, you know, March 50, yeah. You know, smoke 10. Yeah. I could fall back on the full field pack, but I couldn't get up with it. And the guys would help me. But, hey, it didn't turn out altogether bad. I got a Bronze Star for bravery. I serve my country. And if they passed that flag past me again right now and said, hey, you arthritic old man, we need you, I'd go again. I really would. I love this guy. I'm a third generation American by way of County Cork, Ireland.
Is that your bars?
Yep, that's my stuff.
Your final rank
That's my sergeant first class. You believe that? 18 years old. So myself and my brother Johnny joined. My brother Kevin joined. I joined. My brother Bernard tried to join, but he had an eye injury, and he tried to fake the eye chart over at Camp Chaffee, and he couldn't even see out of his left eye. It was so bad. He later got that fixed, by the way. But so three of us wound up in Korea in the winter of 1950, and my brother Kevin was killed on Heartbreak Ridge. I brought his body home. My brother Johnny, he stayed in. He was in the engineers. He's one of the sapper teams that blew the Han River Bridge when the Chinese crossed the Yalu. By the way, my brother Kevin got the Silver Star, which is the, I guess, on the Army, about the second highest, right under the Congressional Medal of Honor. Quite a guy. He was 22, by the way, when he was killed. So I came home, and then I wanted to go to OU. But in the meantime, it was between breaks, so I went up to the local newspaper. I'd sent columns home constantly. I didn't even know it. I was already famous when I got back to McAllister, because every time there was a little downtime in Korea, I'd write a little column home about whatever I saw and whatever I was doing. And they were publishing them, and they were putting them on the editor had a page one left-hand column, the full column, and that's where my columns were appearing. So when I got home, I was already something of a celebrity, because I was writing about all the kids that I knew. I'd run into the kids from McAllister in the 45th and so on. And so I went to work for the newspaper there until I could start OU.
Frosty would attend OU on the GI Bill, but the classroom would only serve to frustrate a budding journalist.
I went in one day to see Dr. Fayette Copeland, the dean, and I said, hey, I'm really unhappy. And he said, why don't you go to work? He said, that's what you want to do, don't you? You want to be a writer, don't you? You want to report. And I said, you bet. I loved it down at the news capital. He said, well, you won't have any trouble finding a job, because you can handle words pretty well in the journalism department. My little semi-fame had spread. So I got a job, believe it or not, at the Muskogee Phoenix. And I started as a police reporter, and inside of months, I was sports editor.
Wow.
I mean, from police reporter to sports editor. And the Muskogee Roughers at that time had four starters at OU, including the Burris brothers. Woo! That was tall cotton. I was going up on Monday for Bud Wilkinson's, he had that Monday press conference for the media. Oh, boy, you talk about it. I was suddenly in tall cotton. But it was such a rotten newspaper. It was so corrupt, the Muskogee Phoenix in those days.
Frosty quit the Phoenix following a request from the paper's managing editor.
He sent me over to the police department one night. He said, hey, kid, go to the chief's office. He's just across the alley from the paper, and pick up. There's a package over there for me. And I came back carrying a peck sack full of whiskey bottles. And I put them down on his desk, and I said, what is this? And he said, my wife, she's having a party at the country club. She's a big golfer, by the way. She's a pro. In fact, it was a woman on the pro circuit for a while. And said, she's having a big party. And, you know, they just pour this out anyhow. This is, you know, they confiscated. Oklahoma was dry then. I set that stuff down and resigned on the spot.
Really?
Yeah, no job in sight. I had to borrow $200 from my mother-in-law, McAllister, while I was waiting to make my next connection.
Well, it takes some guts.
Oh, no, it takes some stupidity. I've told many a journalism class since then, look, give yourself a go-to-hell fund. Every month, put away a little aside. Just, I don't care how much, but enough where if they tell you that you got to do something bad or something wrong, you can tell them to go to hell, but you can still survive and get to the next job.
After the Phoenix, Frosty got a job with the Lawton Constitution, but quit that job after the publisher refused to print Frosty's two-part story on slot machines, saying the story would be bad for the community's image. Frosty went on to work for a Lawton radio station before beginning a lengthy career with the Tulsa Tribune. That story, plus the beginnings of The Observer, next time on The Voices of Oklahoma. I'm Kelly Burling.
That I love so. Glow, little glowworm, glow. Glow, little glowworm, turn the key on. You are equipped with taillight neon. You got a cute vest pocket master, which you can make both slow and faster. I don't know who you took the shine to, or who you're out to make a sign to. I got a gal that I love so. Glow, little glowworm, glow.